Good morning, everybody. Not a good morning.
Did you make copies of these?
Those are for the rest.
It's my pleasure to introduce once again Professor Menachem Kellner, who's the head of the Department of Jewish Thought at the University of Haifa. Professor Kellner is one of the leading writers on Maimonides in the world. He's the author of many books, including Dogma and Medieval Jewish Thought, Maimonides on Human Perfection, Maimonides on Judaism and the Jewish People, Maimonides on the Decline of the Generations. You're getting a pattern here. And certain books that he's now becoming more well known for, including Must a Jew Believe Anything? And if you stay around for the next session, we'll talk about the core ideas in that book with him and Dr. Shapiro. His latest book is called Maimonides' Confrontation with Mysticism, which focuses on Maimonides' opposition to what Professor Kellner calls proto-Kabbalah, and that was published recently as a finalist for the National Jewish Book Award. It's my pleasure to introduce Menachem Kellner.
Thank you very much. Does this work? Okay, great. Actually, I thought this was supposed to be a Jewish organization. We were starting only 5 minutes late, so there's obviously some problem here. Then I've been told to keep you riveted to your seats till 10:25, so I'll talk for a little bit less than an hour, I hope, and then leave time for questions. And if you have no questions, I'll talk some more, so I recommend that you have questions. Now, the title that Elliot and Jay gave to my talk is Transforming Judaism, Philosophy, Kabbalah, and the Legacy of the Rambam. And clearly they meant by that for me to talk about my last book that Elliot mentioned, Maimonides' Confrontation with Mysticism. But I don't see any point in telling you what's in the book, because then you won't go out and buy it. So I'm going to be talking about that subject, but not about things that are in the book, but that grow out of it and that relate to the title. But most importantly, the topics I want to address this morning relate to the overall theme of today's conference, and that is the question of authority in Judaism. And I want to explain the connection between what I'm about to say and to the overall theme of the conference. I guess one of the most important points I want to make this morning is that it makes no sense to speak of Judaism. There are so many competing expressions of Judaism within what we would call the Orthodox world. I'm not talking about non-Orthodox expressions of Judaism. But Rambam's Judaism is truly rejected by most other Orthodox Jews, and he truly rejected important elements of what today are dominant in the Orthodox world. Now, that doesn't mean that he is right and the other Jews are wrong, or that they're right and he is wrong. It means that there are many different flavors of being a from Jew, an Orthodox Jew. Rambam expresses one flavor, and there are very different flavors floating around and have been floating around for the 800 years since his day and also from before him. So if I can convince you that it makes sense to speak of a Maimonidean Judaism, which is rejected by other Jews who would happily daven in the same shul with Rambam, and if I can convince you that there is a non-Maimonidean or anti-Maimonidean Judaism held by Jews who would also be welcomed into his shul, then I will have done what I want to do this morning. Now, any talk on Rambam has to start off with the fact that, just as I just said, there are many Judaisms, many Orthodox Judaisms, there are also many Rambams. And this is an extremely important point, because I think intellectual honesty demands that I tell you that you're going to hear from me an interpretation of Maimonides. Luckily for you, it is the correct interpretation of Maimonides. But I am aware of the fact that there are other interpretations. And the reason that this is so is that Rambam wrote, in such a way that he could address simultaneously many different audiences. And he did this on purpose, and he more or less tells us that he did this. He was so effective at it that to this day there is tremendous debate over what Rambam actually meant to say. Now, for people like me, this is an excellent thing, because it gives me the opportunity to write books and articles about Rambam on this, Rambam on that, and Rambam on that. And these books and articles are written by people like me not only because Rambam is important and because he is very interesting, and because no matter how much we protest that we are disinterested scholars of medieval Judaism, everyone who writes about Rambam is actually writing about their version of Judaism today and connecting it to Rambam or relying upon Rambam. There's always some kind of contemporary subtext in everything I've ever written, certainly anything I've ever written, but also anything I've ever read about Rambam. They say that he's called Maimonides in European languages because there's always Maimonides and Marxmonides and Yormonides and Hermonides, so it's a way of remembering that there are many different Rambams. And he tells us in the introduction to the Guide of the Perplexed that there are seven reasons why one might find contradictions in a published work. And of these seven, the fifth and the seventh are most interesting because he tells us there are contradictions in his work which relate to the fifth and seventh causes. The fifth cause is pedagogical. Namely, sometimes when you write a book, you have to, in effect, lie at the beginning because you can't. The reader has to be brought to a point where she or he can understand what's going on. So you either express things in too crude a term or actually say things which you don't believe because they have to be put down, so to speak, at first so that afterwards you can bring the reader along to where he or she can actually understand what you're trying to say. A crude example of this would be an introductory geometry textbook which doesn't tell the reader that lines have only one dimension or two dimensions. What is it? And points have one dimension or no dimension? Zero. You get what I'm trying to say, okay? No kid in ninth grade actually believes that. They think a line is something you draw on a piece of paper, and you can, you know, the width of it can be measured at all. And the teacher doesn't disabuse the child of that view until much later on, after they've gotten some of the basics. So Rambam says that's one reason why there are contradictions in his work. And the second reason he says is that sometimes it's important for the author of the work to hide his true views from the reader. And therefore, the author of the work will write down things which he knows are contradict. You know, he'll take different stands in different parts of the book by way of hiding his own true views from the reader. And then the Rambam says, on contradictions in this book, the Guide of the Perplexed, are there because of the fifth and seventh causes. He tells us, straight up, that he has an esoteric doctrine, a secret teaching. Now, you have to realize, in making the claim that he has an esoteric doctrine, he's not saying something unprecedented in Judaism. In the Mishnah, in the second chapter of the Tractate Chagiga, we are told there are certain things which may not be taught in public. Now, if there are things which the Chazal teach us may not be taught in public, it means they also had an esoteric teaching. They had a teaching which was not meant to be broadcast to everyone. So when Rambam says that he has, not so much he would make the claim that the Torah has an esoteric teaching, he's not doing anything new. And to cite an example from a source that he would not be happy to have me cite, the same thing can be found in every single Kabbalistic text. Kabbalistic texts are built upon the idea that the Torah has a secret teaching, and that this teaching is not meant to be broadcast to everyone on television, and that it's meant to be passed on secretly. And it was only in the aftermath of the Rambam, as Moshe Edel argues, that the Kabbalah became public. In fact, Edel claims this is a reaction to the Rambam. That's another story altogether. So when Rambam says he has an esoteric doctrine, there's nothing new here that he hasn't now I really feel like I'm at home in Israel. He's not making some new claim about the nature of Torah and Judaism. Also, Rambam, then the question arises, well, what is his esoteric teaching? And that's where people like me get to make a living. And there's a whole scale of interpretations. There's one side of the scale says that Maimonides' esoteric teaching is that Aristotle was right in every important point, and that I, Rambam, do not really believe in Torah Min HaShamayim, Torah from heaven, Torah from Sinai. I'm hiding my true heretical Aristotelian views from the public, for obvious reasons. And if you read my works carefully enough, you will discover their claims totally at variance with every possible interpretation of traditional Judaism. Until about 30 years ago, this was the dominant academic view. Then the writings of David Hartman and the late Yitzhak Tversky basically opened up a whole new area of interpretation. They weren't the first, but they were the most important, which sees Rambam as doing what he claims to be doing, namely seeking a synthesis between science and Torah. That's like in the mid-range of interpretations. All the way over on the other end are interpretations which say the Rambam was the most square possible, in our terms, Haredi Jew you could imagine, who pretended to be interested in Aristotelian philosophy. And now this is not a new interpretation. The Rivash, Rav Yitzchak ben Sheshet Perfet from the early 15th century, late 14th, early 15th century, he doesn't say it in so many words, but he basically says the odd things that are found in Rambam are there in order to serve as a kind of lifesaver. To Jews who are drowning in a sea of doubt, Rambam throws them a lifesaver to pull them back into the shores of Torah, so to speak. That's not quite the analogy he uses, but that's the idea. So we see already, within a few hundred years of his death, Rambam is being interpreted as someone who in no way deviates from the norm. Okay, so what is his true view? Again, luckily for you, you're about to hear. Rambam's true view isn't actually, from our perspective, looking at it historically, an amalgamation of what Chazal taught and what Aristotle taught. And he could do that because he was convinced that there's only one truth. There are no multiple truths. There are no competing truths. There's only one truth. And he was also convinced that Kodesh Baruch Hu, God, wrote two books. One book is called Torah and one book is called science, in our language. He would have said Teva, the world. Those are the only two books that God wrote. If you want, and there can be no contradictions between them because there's one author. So that in principle, there can't be a contradiction between what Torah teaches and what science teaches because they're both written by the same divine author. And that, he says, is the real secret teaching of Judaism, which brings him to all kinds of what would be considered unusual positions, but not one of them in his own eyes are heterodox. In other words, Rambam's secret positions are, in his own eyes, the true teaching of Torah. And, you know, we don't have time to give you many, many examples, but he comes to, we'll put it politely, very unusual interpretations, which we all know the famous stories of how his works were banned and burned and et cetera, the 100 years or so after his death. It didn't go over easily. After a while, to adopt an analogy from another religious tradition, he became a sacred cow, and no one could furthermore ban or burn his books, but they could do the next best thing, which is interpret them out of existence. And that's basically what happened. If we have time, I'll tell you interesting stories about the way in which this works out in practice in my own life. Okay, all this is by way of introduction. So I want to now spend the rest of the time allotted to me just taking up a couple of examples of the kinds of views that Rambam actually held, as I understand him, and which will, you can't be convinced because I can't lay out all the proofs here, but if you can see that this is a reasonable way of interpreting the Rambam, you'll be forced to accept my conclusion that there are many different orthodoxies within the Jewish world, both in his day and in ours. Now, I want to focus on just two or three issues. We'll see how much time we have. And you have two texts, which we'll get to in a few minutes, okay? So prepare yourselves for the experience.
We only have one.
No, you have one page with two texts. It's a really sophisticated technology where you can cut and paste and then print them together. And okay. I'm going to, if you don't mind, actually read a couple of paragraphs now, like a formal presentation, and then get back to the actual lecture. As I understand him, Rambam expressed a vision of Judaism as a remarkably naturalist religion of radical responsibility. A religion in which concrete behavior serves the needs of abstract thought. Translated into English, the mitzvot are not an end in themselves, they are a tool, a means to to the accomplishment of another end, and that other end is in the realm of abstract thought, i.e., will fulfill the mitzvot in order to prepare ourselves to understand properly. And that proper understanding is the actual aim of the Torah. The mitzvot are a tool to achieve that proper understanding. And we all know that tools can be better or worse, but they are never such that they cannot be replaced. In other words, in Rambam's eyes, the Torah is the most effective way of training a person to become the kind of human being who can go on to philosophical speculation. It's the most effective, it's the best, the most efficient. Obviously, it comes from God, but it's not the only. In other words, in principle or in theory, as someone who never heard of the Torah, never heard of the Jews, could achieve a level of moral and what we would call spiritual perfection that would enable them to go on to understand the truths that the Torah teaches, not in the language of the Torah, obviously. And furthermore, Maimonides' Judaism is a religion in which that abstract thought is to be understood as the deepest layer of the Torah, and as a system which, at least in Maimonides' day, could be most clearly and accurately expressed in the vocabulary of the Neoplatonized Aristotelianism, which he accepted as one of the highest expressions of the human spirit. Again, translating that into normal English. We'll get to this in the next session, but Rambam proposed that every Jew would be forced to agree to 13 statements of Jewish faith. He didn't make them, those of you who are familiar with them are familiar with them from poems that are based on them. The Gimli Karim, Yigdal, and there are hundreds of poems based on Rambam's principles. But he actually wrote a long text in Arabic. And in this text, he describes or works out, explains in detail most of the principles. And in the first five, at least, the explanations are philosophical. And they are couched in the vocabulary of a particular kind of philosophy, which he accepted as the truest way of describing the world in technical terms. But that means that for Rambam, to be a good Jew, one who actually does accept the 13 principles, you have to be able to work within the context of what we call Neoplatonism, the philosophical school whose language, whose thought structure, whose view of the universe, Rambam accepted as, at least to his day, the best way of describing the world in technical, secular terms. This Judaism was at one and the same time deeply elitist and profoundly universalist. Deeply elitist because not everyone can understand the philosophical issues. Not everyone can make the truths taught by science and philosophy their own. But at the same time, profoundly universalist because if you can do that, it doesn't matter if you're Jewish or Gentile, black or white, and even doesn't matter if you're a man or a woman. Now, Rambam and Averroes Ibn Rushd are the only two medieval figures whom I found, me and my colleagues and friends, who actually believe that women are created in the image of God. All other medievals, Muslim, Christian, and Jewish alike, who talked about the issue, not everyone addressed it, right? But anyone who addressed the issue of the nature of womankind, in effect says that women are created in the image of men. And men are created in the image of God. So because Rambam places so much emphasis on the importance of understanding, and understanding is not a uniquely Jewish trait, not something that only Jews have, therefore his position becomes profoundly universalist, in the sense that in principle you don't have to be Jewish in order to accomplish the highest ends of the Torah. He thinks it's a much, much easier thing to do if you are Jewish. And he certainly thinks that if you are Jewish, you are bound by the commandments. We're dealing here with a figure from the 12th century. He wasn't some kind of modern, liberal, multicultural, you know, your way, my way, it's all the... No, he was a very hard-nosed... Remember, what was his first name? Rabbi! Okay? My wife always tells me to remember... I speak so much about his philosophy that she reminds me that very often people forget the fact that he was first and foremost... Rabbi. He was Rambam before he was Maimonides, okay? That's a very important point to keep in mind. But still, the universalism implicit in what he had to teach is a function of his understanding of the importance of a ph- fulfilling ourselves as human beings through rational thought. Let me just add parenthetically, it is my understanding that this is all a function of one single point, and that is his absolute acceptance of the Aristotelian notion that human beings are best defined as rational animals. Once you define a human being as a rational animal, then to fulfill ourselves as human beings means to exercise our rational abilities to the greatest extent possible. Now, this is also the source both of his universalism, because rationality is not unique to Jews. In fact, I'm willing to make the argument that it's found less among many kinds of Jews than other areas of the world. Anybody who lives in Israel has to become convinced that rational behavior is not the hallmark of the Jewish people. But it's also deeply elitist, because what happens if a person is born such they never have an opportunity to learn science and philosophy? They're in deep trouble. They never really become fully human beings. So that by the same token, his definition of humans as rational animals brings him to the kind of universalism in principle I've been talking about. It also brings him to radical elitism, which I should point out is the tradition of Western philosophy from the very beginning. Plato and Aristotle taught a version of a view of understanding the world which was radically elitist. The philosophers were the best people. Philosophers should be kings. I might add, I've spent my life among philosophers. I do not subscribe to that Platonic teaching at all. Okay, Rambam was brought to crystallize and express this vision of Judaism because the Jewish world in his day was, in his view, debased and paganized. In other words, why did Rambam have to write his philosophy, and why did he have to write it esoterically? Because the Jewish world had lost its moorings. It had ceased being true to Torah and become corrupted in by the adoption of, in Rambam's eyes, basically pagan views of the Torah. Now, this is a very harsh claim, and I'm not about to stand here and tell you what Rambam would think about this, that, or the other expression of Judaism in the modern world. But, well, I will. No, I really won't. I don't have the chutzpah to speak in the name of the Rambam about any issue except one. And I'll just tell you what that one issue is. If anybody comes to you and says they're going to a Maimonidean doctor, tell them Rambam thinks they're an idiot. Okay? Medicine is a science. You go to the best specialist of the day. You don't read. Rambam would say, 800 years after my death, you're coming to read the Mishnah Torah to learn how to live a healthy life? You're a fruitcake. So there I am when you speak in the... I was telling somebody here that a couple of weeks ago we found in a huge supermarket not far from our home in Haifa Rambam soap. And I had this real crisis of conscience because I wanted to buy it to show it to my students, but I didn't want these idiots to make money off this total ridiculous falsehood. And Rambam wouldn't allow me to steal it. So I was only Rambam... Moshe Rabbeinu, Kodesh Baruch Hu. I ended up buying it, but I really felt bad about giving 15 shekels to the people who were basically scamming the world with through the Rambam. In any event, that goes on a lot. You can at the Eged bus station in Haifa, you can buy a Rambam ring, 5 medals, which you wear. It will preserve you from all kinds of problems. If they promised me it would preserve from overweight, I might consider it. But the anyway, all this stuff is. So I think in his eyes, the world in which we live, the Jewish world we live, is no less paganized and stupid than the world in which he found himself. But he also knew if he just said this outright, first of all, no one would listen to him. Or if they did, people who need this kind of crutch, this is a point that Mark made last night, that people who need this kind of crutch would be lost. So he wrote in a very subtle fashion. I like to express in the following fashion, not that my younger brother Chalila is crude or paganized, the Hefech, not at all, but Rambam wrote such that my younger brother, the Haredi rabbi from Lakewood, can read his writings and not be upset. And I can read his writings and be very happy. And the reason that Rambam did that was that he knew if he addressed his writings to me, then people like my brother wouldn't be able to accept what he wrote, and he would not accomplish anything. He would not help Jews free themselves from what he considered to be the pagan structures of their Jewish religion. I want to make one other general point. Rambam, unlike my daughter Rivka, hated clutter. He was a fanatic organizer and systematizer. The Mishneh Torah is the best expression of that cast of mind. I really believe this is a personality issue as opposed to a philosophical one. But this hatred of clutter also brought him to hate metaphysical clutter. He looked for a universe which was the simplest possible. And this he was giving expression to a very fundamental idea of Western philosophy, which is called Occam's Razor. Namely, when you have two options to explain a phenomenon, you always go for the simpler one, the more elegant one, the one that demands fewer investments, so to speak, intellectually and in argument terms. So Rambam was deeply convinced that God created an efficient universe, a universe which operated on the simple in the sense that least cumbersome, least complex, with fundamental laws which obtain everywhere. It sounds very modern. He wouldn't have spoken in terms of laws. That's a post-scientific revolution or post-Newtonian form of language. He would say natures which obtain in every case. His view of the world was very naturalist. In other words, there's very little room for monkey business. The late Yeshayahu Leibowitz liked to say that Rambam disdained the idea that God was busily pushing buttons and pulling strings all the time to make the world run. Let me express it in the following fashion. My wife and I moved to Israel in 1980, and out of misguided Zionism bought a Ford Escort because it was assembled in Israel. Now, that car had this tremendous desire to be in the garage. And every Montag and Dornishtig, every Monday and Thursday, we would take it home for a visit. So, after a number of years, we managed, thank God, to unload that car and bought a Suzuki. A little Japanese car. Now, the Japanese Suzuki had this allergy to the garage. Twice a year, whether the car wanted to or not, I would schlep it down to the garage, have an oil change. I would go donate blood at the same time. We were both involved in fluid exchanges, the car and I. Ran like a dream. Now, what kind of world does God create? People whom Rambam disdains believe that God creates a world of Ford Escorts that need constant intervention. Constant fiddling, constant tuning up. Rambam believed that God created a world like Suzuki's that run very well the way they were originally planned. Now, you may smile at this, but the consequence is that for Rambam, miracles almost never happen. Because miracles are signs of the inability of God to create a world that runs well on its own. So, whereas other people want to find miracles in every event, Rambam thinks that's to malign God, to make God an ineffective creator. Now, this is we're dealing here with very different understandings of the nature of God, Torah, Judaism, and religion in general. And they're deeply different understandings. It's not just, like I said before, flavors. These are very different forms of Judaism. The Rambam's Judaism is, on the one hand, empowering because a lot of responsibility falls on you, because God isn't there pushing you in this direction or that direction. God gives you the tools with which to make yourself, and either you do or you don't. You either stand or fall, sink or swim, whatever analogy you want. The view which he disdains is much more comforting, because God is there all the time, being involved in your life in a very direct fashion. Now, I'm not here to judge which view is better for any particular person, but I do want to point out to you that both views are available for Jews. Because Rambam is the unique individual of whom it can be said that if we can show that he held the view, that fact makes the view Jewishly legitimate. It's enough to show that Rambam held view X for me to be able to say, therefore, view X is an acceptable Jewish view. I can't say that about Levi ben Gershom or Albag the Mashal, I can't say that about a long list of other Jewish thinkers whose authority is not such that if they can be shown to have held a position, therefore that position becomes kosher. And that's why Rambam is the subject of so much debate. If I can convince some Haredi rabbi in Toronto that Rambam held a view which this Haredi rabbi rejects, he would have to admit that that view is one which Judaism tolerates at least. Because you cannot admit that Rambam held a heterodox view. And that's why the issue always turns on interpretation. Rather than accept the fact that this is a kosher view, they'll say Rambam didn't hold it. If I had a nickel, Canadian, American, I don't care which, for every time a student looked at a text of Rambam that I showed her or him, and the student said, "Aval lo yitachen sheRambam katav et zeh," it is not possible that Rambam wrote this, I would still come to lecture because you're a nice crowd, but I wouldn't need to. That's the common response. You know, we just, it can't be that he held these views. So we have, in other words, I was talking about his resistance to metaphysical clutter and the fact that he wants a simple, what we would call, in our terms, scientifically describable universe. But it has consequences. For example, for Rambam, angels do not exist, except in a metaphorical way. There are no entities with wings and halos and harps floating around, or however you want to view the Jewish angel. He puts it very explicitly. Angels are the biblical term for natural forces. You can find that explicitly stated in Guide of the Perplexed, Part 2, Chapter 6. And there are other ways in which he uses the term angel also, but they're all naturalist. They all derive from his view of the scientific / philosophical view of the universe. Whereas other people try, if there are no angels, by the way, what also are there not? Devils, demons, exactly. You know, there's no room in his universe for all kinds of entities between us and God. Now again, this is a very important religious view of the world. There are no intermediaries. Not rabbis, not angels, not devils. You are responsible yourself before God. There's no one there to share the responsibility. Again, Rambam is consistent in adopting views which demand a lot, which expect a high level of maturity from the people to whom he's addressing. And it's simply not for everybody. Now, the upshot of what I'm saying is that Rambam was a religious reformer who tried to change the Judaism of his day in dramatic ways. Did he succeed? I want to hear all of you say together with me, no. Louder. How about a little more emphatically? Okay, thank you very much. It's fair to say that in the history of Judaism, if I'm right in what I've said to this point, and I certainly am, then Rambam is one of the great failures, because the Judaism which survived his death is not at all the Judaism he sought to leave behind us. There are just two areas where he really succeeded, one in ways I don't think he anticipated, and the other way he actually had a success. The first way he succeeded is in putting Judaism on a firm dogmatic basis. Came up time and time again last night, will come up in our next session in a little more than half an hour. Until Rambam, no one in the Jewish world ever said that there are Ikarei Emunah, dogmas, doctrines in Judaism. You can argue that it was implicit, and Rambam only made it explicit, which I think is incorrect, or you can argue, which I think is the truth, he did something new here. And I'm not going to get into this subject, it's our next panel, and also I've written a lot about it, but to my mind this is a dramatic change in the nature of the Jewish religion. It goes from a biblically based religion, which is biblically and Talmudically based religion, which is not interested in what we think, but in what we do. How many commandments in the Torah begin, "Thou shalt not believe that"? Cursed be she who holds the following view. And God said to Moses, tell the Jewish people, accept the following dogmatic teaching. The Torah is not that kind of text. It's all about how we should behave. And of course, from that, we learn tremendously important lessons about values, about human nature, about psychology, about society. But these are things we learn from the Torah. We don't find them explicitly taught in it. Or at least if we find them, we find very many different varieties of views taught in the Torah on these kinds of questions. So that he certainly succeeded in that. And the second point where he succeeded entirely and really made a change is one that you probably will not think of as one of his successes, but it is. How did God take the Jewish people out of the land of Israel? Vizdra'an etu yav yad chazakah, right? With an outstretched arm and a strong hand. How many people in this room who consider themselves traditional Jews believe that God has a hand and an arm? That's good, because if any of you said yes, I'd have to get up and leave, because I wouldn't be permitted to stay in the room with heretics of that nature. Why do none of you who hold themselves to be traditional Jews believe that God has an arm or a hand? The answer is, Rambam convinced you. Simply that. The Torah is a text which describes God entirely in human terms. Not just in bodily terms, but in human emotional terms. God is described as an entity having emotions. And it was Rambam who forced us to all of us to admit that is allegorical. Dibrat Torah kilshon b'nei Adam, which is not the way that expression is used in the Talmud. But Rambam, following a tradition of earlier Jewish philosophers like Bach Yevin and Pakuda, teaches us that that expression means that the Torah is speaking popularly. What it means, the philosophical claims that God exists, is one and incorporeal. I think everybody in this room admits that this is what Judaism teaches, and you admit it because Rambam managed to succeed dramatically on that point. If you read the Talmud, God is described in even more human terms in the Talmud than in the Torah, and I have no idea what Chazal meant by that. I do not know if Chazal thought that God was incorporeal, if they thought that God was as they described him, if there were various views. My own opinion, based on totally no knowledge, is that they gave very little thought to the question, that it wasn't an issue for them. And that's why we don't know what they thought, because that was not where they focused their attention. Rambam certainly focused our minds on that. Okay, all this by way of introduction. I just now want, in the time remaining, to learn two texts with you, which illustrate, I think, very clearly some of the more general points I've just made in our introductory discussion. The first text is long, and I'll read it quickly, and then just focus on a couple of sentences. But I want to first give some background. Rambam wrote all of his works, all of his letters, all of his halachic works, all of his advice, everything, all his tshuvot, his halachic responsa. He wrote all that in Arabic, in Hebrew letters. A whole big story about that, too. In the entire long history of the Jewish people, there were only two languages which Jews spoke or used occasionally, which were never written down in Hebrew letters. One is Latin, because it was so clearly identified with the church. There is no Judeo-Latin. There's Judeo-Greek, Judeo-Arabic, Judeo-Spanish, Judeo-German, which you call Yiddish, but there is no Judeo-Latin. And there's one other language Jews have used in their history which never appears in Hebrew letters. There is no Judeo-English. There is no English written in Hebrew letters the way Yiddish is German written in Hebrew letters, Ladino is. And I think that's because English-speaking Jews are even more acculturated, even the firmest of them. Art Scroll writes its books in English letters, not in Hebrew letters. This is a unique phenomenon in the history of the Jewish people so far, where you have Jewish texts written in a foreign language in a foreign alphabet. Rambam wrote Jewish texts in Arabic, but in the Hebrew letters, and with a lot of Hebrew thrown in, like Yiddish is German with a lot of Hebrew used. And we call that Judeo-Arabic. One book was written in Hebrew, and that is the Mishneh Torah, his code of Jewish law. He called it Mishneh Torah, which basically is what Chazal called the fifth book of the Torah, the Dvarim, because it is, in effect, a summary, a repetition of the entire Chumash. And Rambam called his book Mishneh Torah, and we'll see immediately why, which apparently, we don't really know for a fact when this happened, but it sufficiently aggravated people for them to give it a nickname. And in traditional context, the book is called Hayad HaChazakah, the strong hand, which is no insult, right? I mean, God, it comes from the expression that God has a strong hand. It's called that because the Hebrew word Yad has a numerical value of 14, and the book is 14 volumes. But people couldn't bring themselves, apparently, we don't know for a fact, but apparently couldn't bring themselves to call it Mishneh Torah, repetition or summary of the Torah, so they called it the strong hand. In any event, this is a revolutionary book in Judaism because it, for the first time, gathers together in a systematic fashion, for the first time it gathers together the entire body of Jewish law, and it does so in a systematic fashion. I like to tell my students, and it's a bit of an exaggeration here, but I think it's a helpful idea, that the Mishneh Torah is a Jewish book written in a Greek style, almost axiomatically, the elements of Euclid, Whereas the Guide of the Perplexed is a Greek book written in a Jewish style because it's very midrashic. But the content is very foreign to at least the way the Jewish tradition developed around Rambam's time, because much of the content has to do with philosophical conceptions of God and the universe. So I believe it's helpful to see the Mishneh Torah as a very Jewish book, but written in a Greek form. And that Greek form is extremely systematic. And Rambam sometimes gives the impression of being like a 20th century academic, because every book comes with a long introduction in which the Rambam explains why he wrote the book as he did, what he was trying to accomplish in it, surveys the previous literature. It's, you know, when you read his introduction to the Mishnah, his introduction to the Mishneh Torah, even his introduction to the Guide of the Perplexed, you really get a sense here of someone who was trained at some fine German university. You know where the world's last great German university is? On Mount Scopus. That's like an in-joke for academics, I'm sorry, but... And it's not a compliment, but... So he's extremely systematic even in his introductions. At the end of the introduction to the Mishneh Torah, which is a text accessible on the internet in English, it's very interesting. It's a survey of the entire history of the Oral Torah with a slant which is unusual. And you can easily find it on the internet if you want to read it. At the end, he writes the following paragraph. We're going to read it together quickly because it's a long one. He's explaining why he wrote the book. In our times, severe troubles prevail and all are in distress. The wisdom of our Torah scholars has disappeared and the understanding of our discerning men is hidden. Thus, the commentaries, the settled laws, and the responses to questions that the Gaonim wrote, which had once seemed clear, have in our times become hard to understand, so that only a few properly understand them. And one hardly needs to mention the Talmud itself, the Babylonian Talmud, the Jerusalem Talmud, the Sifra, the Sifri, the Tosefta, which all require a broad mind, a wise soul, and considerable study before one can correctly know from them what is forbidden or permitted in the other rules of the Torah. For this reason, I, Moshe, son of Maimon the Sfaradi, he was proud all of his life of having come from Sfarad. It doesn't mean Sfaradi in the contemporary sense. It means someone who came from Andalusia. Became stirred to action, and relying on the help of the rock, blessed be he, intently studied all these books. No small project. The Babylonian Talmud, the Jerusalem Talmud, the Sifra, the Sifri, the Tosefta. Intently studied all these books, for I saw fit to write what can be determined from all these works in regard to what is forbidden and permitted and unclean and clean and all the other rules of the Torah. Everything in clear language and terse style, so the whole oral Torah should become thoroughly known to all. Without bringing problems and solutions or differences of view, one saying such and such and another saying something else. But rather clear, convincing, and correct statements in accordance with legal rules drawn from all these works and commentaries that have appeared from the time of Moses to the present. There should be a period there. Rambam is telling us that he's trying to bring an end to a certain kind of literature, the Talmudic literature of give and take, and give us the law as it should be understood without citing any sources. Now, here's another example of his tremendous failure. The Mishneh Torah did not end that kind of literature. Rather, it precipitated a whole new generation. I'm not exaggerating when I say there have probably been thousands of commentaries written on the Mishneh Torah. Each commentary is an ironic response to Rambam's desire. This is so that all the rules should be accessible to great and small, and the rules of each and every commandment, and the rules of the legislations of the Torah scholars and prophets. In short, so that a person should need no other work in the world, in the rules of any of the laws of Israel, but that this work might collect the entire oral Torah, including the positive legislations, the customs, and the negative legislations enacted from the time of Moshe our teacher to the writing of the Talmud, as the Gaonim interpreted for us in all the works which they wrote after the Talmud. Thus I have called this work Mishneh Torah, the complete restatement or summary of the Oral Torah. Here comes the kicker, guys. For a person reads the written law first, five books of Moses, and then reads this work and knows from it the entire Oral Torah, the Torah Shebaal Peh, without needing to read any other book between them. Give me an example of a book between the Torah Shebichtav and the Mishneh Torah. Yes, the Babylonian Talmud, Jerusalem Talmud, Sifra, Sifri, the books he cited. Now, as you can well imagine, this text is not popular in rabbinic circles. It wasn't popular at the time he wrote it, and it isn't popular to this day. And it has been the subject of endless interpretations. I do not for a moment believe that Rambam intended for Jews to stop studying Talmud. That's too ridiculous. I could go into a more formal argument, but I cannot believe that perhaps the greatest Talmudist in the history of the world said no one else has to study this. But what I do believe is going on here is that Rambam wants to make room for other things. He wants people to be Talmidei Chachamim, Talmudic scholars, but not to spend their entire lives exclusively on that. So that once you've learned how to do it, you get to the point where, done that, and I have to go on to study other aspects of Torah. Now, before I explain those other aspects, I want you to realize the revolutionary character of even my conservative interpretation of this text. We won't, of course, read it as it's written and simply say Rambam is totally changing the nature of the Jewish syllabus. I don't think that's going on here at all. I think Rambam wants Jews to be Talmidei Chachamim. But he doesn't see the study of Talmudic literature as an end in itself. He sees it as a tool. And that tool is to learn how to learn to live. So, a Jew should not obey a commandment simply in an orthopraxic kind of way, without understanding what goes into it. So a Jew should study Talmud. But a Jew who spends her entire life studying Talmud will never get to read God's second book, which is science, what we call science, what he would call wisdom or nature or the world. The Mishneh Torah was designed to enable people to get to God's second book. At least that's my interpretation of it. Now, if I'm right, and I am, I was waiting for you to say that. If I'm right, we have here a revolution in the Jewish curriculum, a revolution which totally failed. It was an attempted revolution. To keep people in the Beit HaMidrash until they reached a certain point of development, and then to send them over to the laboratory or the library, while not abandoning the Beit HaMidrash. He really, to my mind, wanted some kind of synthetic human being who studied all of God's works. Now, even those Jews among us who admit that this is what he's doing, which are few and far between because they are committed to the notion that the study of Talmud is in itself a value, that it's better for a guy to spend 20 years in a yeshiva in the same Blat Gemara, reading it without a lot of understanding, than going out to work for a living or studying for a profession or doing learning other things. Because the learning itself is the value. So that Rambam's text here can't be popular among people who hold that to be the case. But even if they admit that what he's saying is that in addition to that value, there's value in studying other things, they will tell you that that was okay for Rambam. But we are not at his level. I mean, I've heard this explicitly said to me, you know, when I was leaving the yeshiva world to go to university. And I didn't know about this text then, but, you know, the ideas were familiar to me. People would say, so you hold yourself to be Rambam? I mean, that's the typical response to this kind of thing, that this text, what Rambam is doing is okay for people like him, not for normal human beings. My response is, if that were the case, why did he address it to normal human beings in his introduction to the work? And I take him seriously here. As you assert, I read him in a very conservative, small-c fashion. Again, I don't take him so literally as to mean that we should stop studying Talmud. But I certainly take him to mean that we should add to the Talmudic curriculum the scientific curriculum. So what you have here is one very clear, explicit text. This is from the Mishneh Torah, not from the Guide of the Perplexed, right? In which he is telling us almost black on white that he's interested in a new kind of Jewish curriculum. This is a very good example of his failure to get his project across or accomplished. I want to look at a second text with you, and I don't want to leave time for questions. in which another kind of his failures comes out. And I don't mean to keep saying failure. I'm going to get into trouble with this later. My wife and I have a long drive ahead of us, and I'm going to get a long discussion about why I shouldn't talk about Rambam's failures. Right? Yes. So let me rephrase it. Rambam's goals were not entirely realized. Okay. And I don't think his goal of creating a Jew whose notion of the worship of the Lord... let me phrase this. The second chapter of the first part of the Mishneh Torah tells us that Jews are obligated to love and fear the Lord, and the way to bring yourself to love and fear of God is by studying nature. He says that there, studying God's works. Okay, you want to fulfill the commandment, V'ahavta Hashem Elokecha, and you shall love the Lord your God. You can't fulfill it only in the Beit Midrash, is what he's saying. You have to fulfill it in the laboratory and the library. Otherwise, you're only loving God partially. So he was insufficiently successful in getting that across to all Jews, okay? Can I go home safely, Jolene? A second way in which this comes across is a text which I love to cite, both because of what I think it teaches and because of the way in which it has been used. Now, the Mishneh Torah is divided into 14 volumes. So where is the midpoint? Even I can figure that out, not too good at math. At the end of the seventh, beginning of the eighth volume, right? Okay. The seventh volume is divided into seven sections. The seventh section deals with the laws of the sabbatical year, where we are right now. That section is divided into 13 chapters. And in the printed editions, that chapter, last chapter, the 13th, is divided into 13 paragraphs. Fortunately, not in the manuscripts, but it'd be so nice if it were. So what we have here is a text which occurs at the midpoint of the Mishneh Torah, in, according to the printers, the 13th paragraph of the 13th chapter of the 7th section of the 7th book. Now, I am far not away from being a Leo Straussian type numerologist who looks for this. You don't have to know what I'm talking about. I simply am not impressed by Strauss's attempts to find numerical significance in every kind of structural thing in the Mishneh Torah or in the Guide of the Perplexed. But this is just too blatant, guys, not to be intended. So I think Rambam is signaling to us that the text which occurs at this amazing spot is significant. Okay? Now, Rambam typically in the Mishneh Torah will utilize the end of a section to give a little sermon. In effect, to tell us what the spiritual upshot of the fairly dry halachot that preceded is. So what do we find at the end of this section, this midpoint of the Mishneh Torah, 7, 7, 13, almost 13? And we all know that 13 is an important number for Judaism and for Rambam, right? 13 principles of faith. In the laws of circumcision, he tells us that the word covenant occurs 13 times in the Torah. I think that's, I don't know if that's his own idea or he got, I didn't see it elsewhere, but I don't, a lot of texts I don't know. 13 is a big deal for Rambam. It was a big deal for Judaism before. 13 midot of God's mercy, 13 rules for deriving laws from the Torah, 13 years for boys to become adults, so to speak. I don't want to belabor this, but I know a very a woman whom I admire in this room who thinks there's a certain 61-year-old who hasn't become an adult yet, so... 13 seems a little bit early. In any event, I'm convinced that Rambam is signaling to us that this text is important. Now, there's another issue here also. This text occurs in the laws of the sabbatical year, which at the end of the Mishneh Torah in his Messianic chapters, Rambam tells us, only will apply fully when the Messiah comes. In other words, there's also a Messianic link to all this. So what does he say? In the previous paragraph, he had said that God would provide sustenance for the tribe of Levi. Not only the tribe of Levi, but each and every individual human being. Each and every individual human being. Kol ba'ei olam. Whose spirit moves him, and whose knowledge gives him understanding to set himself apart in order to stand before the Lord, to serve him, to worship him, and to know him. Who walks upright, as God created him to do. That, I think, is a kind of signal that Rambam is here arguing against the Christian notion of original sin. Because we were born to walk upright. And releases himself from the yoke of the many foolish considerations which trouble people. Such an individual. Now we're talking here about what kind of people? Goyim. Kol ba'e olam. All human beings. All those who come into the world. Such an individual is as consecrated as the Holy of Holies. And his portion and inheritance shall be in the Lord forever and ever. I.e., he is as holy as the Holy of Holies, and he has a share in the world to come. His portion in the Lord will be forever and ever. Also, the Lord will grant him adequate sustenance in this world, the same as he had granted to the priests and to the Levites. Thus indeed did David, peace upon him, say, O Lord, the portion of mine inheritance and of my cup, thou maintainest my lot. As I understand Rambam, he's telling us this is one of the core places where he comes out with his universalistic message. You don't have to be Jewish to achieve the status of Kodesh Kodeshim, Holy of Holies. You don't have to be Jewish to achieve a portion in the Lord forever and ever. You don't have to be Jewish to have God support you. Now, I once taught this text in our shul, and a very intelligent and learned Jew said that you can't be right in your interpretation because it says Kol Ba'e Olam, and that figures in the piyut, the religious poem Unatana Tokev, and that's clearly talking about Jews. So I showed him how Unatana Tokev is derived from a Mishnah in Rosh Hashanah, which is based upon a verse in Tehillim, which is talking about human beings. It's also easy to show that the expression Kol Ba'e Olam, which is found, I think, 6 or 7 times in the Mishneh Torah, always refers to human beings as such, not Jews. But this fellow was so unwilling to accept the outward teaching here that he had to find some way of limiting all this to Jews. 2 minutes? Okay. How do you think this text is used in Lakewood? I cite that because I've written an article about Rav Aaron Kotler Zal's use of this text. Who are Kol Ba'e Olam who achieve the status of Kodesh Kodeshim? Let's hear it. Yeshiva Bachrim. That is the standard interpretation of this text in the Yeshiva world. Now, it says here, in addition, that the Lord will grant him adequate sustenance in this world. Now, who does the Lord's work? No, in this case, the people who donate money to the Yeshiva to provide adequate sustenance. I don't know. I've used this joke someplace here in Toronto, so those of you who heard it will pardon me. A guy takes a girl, goes to meet a shidduch date, and he's talking to the father of the girl while she's getting ready. There's never been a date in the history of the universe when the girl was ready when the guy showed up. And the father says, Zat Hashem, things will work out. Who will support you and my daughter? And the guy says, Hashem will provide. God will provide. And when children come, who will buy them shoes? Hashem. The whole, every time the thing, the question the father asks, the guy says, Hashem will provide. So the father goes upstairs and says to his daughter, you can't go out with this guy. She says, what do you mean? I haven't even met him yet. Why can't I go out with him? He says, he thinks I'm God. Now, there's something really dramatically interesting going on here. In the entire long history of the last 800 years, who was the one halachic figure who explicitly and emphatically said people should not be paid to study Torah? Rambam. Emphatically. So it's Dafka, that Rambam, who is used, and I must say Reb Aaron interprets this text with brilliant homiletical ability. I'm not kidding. His drash here is amazingly effective. He doesn't ignore the text. He darshans it. He interprets it homiletically, but in an extremely effective fashion. He was not a dumb man. But the consequence is to turn Rambam from an opponent to the Kol Eil system to its major supporter. So if you need a further example of Rambam's failure to accomplish fully all of his ends, I think that this is it. But again, I'm not here to say you not to donate money to Lakewood Yeshiva. That would make my brother unhappy. What I'm trying, and here I'm coming to an end, half a minute, I'm trying to emphasize to you that there are many different ways of understanding the obligations and the nature and the ideals and the dreams of Orthodox Judaism. Rambam's way is uncongenial to many other Jews, and the solution which has been developed over the last 800 years is to simply darshan him away, midrashically solve the problem by turning him into a totally uncontroversial, Yiddish-speaking, black-coated Rosh Yeshiva from Eastern Europe. Do I have time for one last joke? No. Okay, that's it. Elliot is a very strict disciplinarian. Thank you.
The reason we don't have time for one more joke is I'm going to substitute some audience questions for your jokes. That's why. So if anybody has a question, I'll take up the mic.
Okay, make it brief.
I have a question, and I'll ask the question. I won't give any speeches. The question is, what you say about Ramban, your interpretation, seems to contradict the idea of authority. I'm not saying he's anti-authoritarian. He's anti-authority in the sense that there's universal rationality, and rationality in philosophy, until at least the postmodern, means that you think for yourself, you make up your own mind, you don't follow any expert advice. And the other part is that he wrote the Mishneh Torah as sort of a online Google method, like Wikipedia. It's an ancient Wikipedia for finding out information and how to do things. So those two ideas contradict the notion of authority.
Can I answer that?
Yes.
Those are very important questions. Let me be very brief. First of all, Rambam believed that there is objective truth and that authority derives from being close to that truth. So he had no problem thinking that he had understood the truth to a greater extent than others and wanting us to accept that truth. That's point A. Point B, your question betrays what we call a post-medieval cast of mind. We think that it's very important to exercise our minds independently to get to the truth. Mendelssohn's friend Lessing is very famous for having said, if God offered me the truth on a silver platter on the one hand and offered me the eternal quest after the truth on the other hand, I would choose the eternal quest after the truth. Rama would have thought he was a lunatic because if God offers you the truth, take it. So we think, my students don't understand this. They think that if they worked hard for a test, they should get a good grade, whether or not they understood the material or wrote a good test. Universities are very Maimonidean. You get graded on results, not on effort. We, as moderns or post-medievals, think that effort counts for a lot. I think it's important to understand how different he is from us in our entire take on these things. And to the question of authority, Rambam introduced his commentary to Pirkei Avot with a long introduction containing 8 chapters. So it's called, Jews are very creative with titles, it's called Rambam's 8 chapters. And there's a little preface to that. And in there he tells his reader that he's going to interpret Avot using other Talmudic texts, but also he's going to be using texts from ancient and modern philosophers. Now, he knows his reader's going to have a heart attack over that. So the next sentence is, accept the truth from whoever said it. In other words, authority does not reside in the position a person holds. It resides in the truth or falsity, or the truth in this case of what they teach. So you can be the greatest rabbi in the world if you speak Narishkeit, it's Narishkeit. You can be the Pope if you speak truth, it's truth. Your position is no impact on whether or not what you say is true. Are these answers to your questions? Well, no, but the authority is, you're right, the authority does not reside in human beings, it resides in the truth. Of course, you'll then say to me, well, who determines the truth? That's a whole separate issue, right?
Question about Korbanot. It's my understanding that the Rambam in Mor Nevuchim seems to indicate that Korbanot were something that the Torah brought to...
No. He doesn't seem to indicate it. He says it.
He says it. Well, is this an example of the esoteric approach that you talked about?
No, because he says it explicitly. I'm sorry to keep interrupting you. Rambam says, Mor Nevuchim Gimel Lamed Bet, that sacrifices were ordered by God as a concession to the pagan character of the Jewish people. That's not secret. That's written black on white. During the break, I'll give you examples of it. It's not too surprising. Well, they are. One example of an esoteric teaching. There is no reward or punishment for the fulfillment of mitzvot in this world or in the world to come in any direct tit-for-tat, checking off the boxes kind of way. That's an esoteric teaching which I think I know he holds. But he never says it in so many words. That's it. I'm sorry I talked too long. We can't have any more questions.